In this segment of the Day at DPL, the thought leadership series of the Advisor Revelations podcast, David Lau, founder and CEO of DPL Financial Partners, welcomes Meg Carpenter. Meg is the CEO of FICOM Partners, a growth marketing firm that specializes in working with financial advisory firms, including RIAs and asset managers.
Today, I'm looking forward to this conversation with Meg Carpenter. Meg, as many of you probably know, is the co-founder and CEO at FICOM Partners, which is a marketing firm that works with RIAs and wealth management firms really to help with organic growth. And we're going to talk about a lot of trends in the RIA industry, as we've both been serving this industry for probably more years than we want to admit at this point. But we've seen a lot of things, and we're going to talk a little bit about what we've seen going on and, you know, some of the exciting developments in the RIA channel. So welcome, Meg.
Thanks so much, David, for having me. And yeah, I got a good chuckle out of that. I actually had dinner with a client last night, and we've been working together for 23 years.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, how is that possible? That can't be. But yeah, I've worked in this industry my entire career. I'm very passionate about financial advisors and advisory firms and the great impact that they deliver to the clients that they serve. So we get a lot of joy out of helping firms serve more clients and have and expand their reach.
That's terrific. And we all know that like organic growth is one of the key things that firms love to have, you know, and it's not an accident, right? I mean, it's got to be a very intentional thing. But we talked before a little bit about some of the evolution in the market. I've been working specifically in the RIA market for a little over 20 years now. And, you know, what was a large firm back then is not so much a large firm anymore, right? We've seen back then there might have been a dozen billion-dollar firms. And if you're a billion-dollar firm, you were huge. But today is very different.
It is different. I think that actually the client that I was having dinner with last night, he and I were talking about, we remember when they celebrated their first billion in assets under management. And they flew up to the Schwab headquarters in San Francisco, and Chuck was there, and like there was this big celebration, you know, and they're now greater than $30 billion firm. And it's really been fascinating to see and experience the momentum within the RIA community and to observe the types of businesses that have emerged as leaders. And I think that how you define leader is probably specific from one person to the next. But I just think that there's unlimited potential. I know that we're in a growth industry. We saw the news today about the $130 billion, was it Merrill Lynch or Morgan Stanley breakaway team? I mean, that's a big deal. It's significant for our industry. So a lot has changed. And I think we have a lot of room still to go from a growth perspective.
Yeah. Back then, I remember, you know, visiting a lot of firms, really getting to know the industry, because, you know, we have similar backgrounds. I've, you know, a marketer by trade. I'd like to do market research, understand, you know, customers and things like that. And I was helping to build a insurance carrier that was going to be focused on the RIA market. And it really struck me that the firms back in those days were real entrepreneurs. And they're still, I mean, still a lot today. But it's not necessarily the case, because there are such institutions, you know, now in the RIA channel, and that's, you know, just continuing to emerge.
Absolutely. And that was a topic of interest. You and I were both at the Echelon Partners Deals and Dealmakers Summit recently. So we can talk about some of the trends that we heard from the stage and around the conversations from that event. And what you just brought up was one of those topics, which is sort of the entrepreneurial mindset and heart that has been a staple of the RIA community, and how that's changing with the consolidation that's happening and with these large national RIAs that are $100 billion firms, $1 trillion firms. I mean, at Echelon's Deals and Dealmakers, Peter Malouk from Creative Planning was on the stage, Fielding Miller from CapTrust, which is a $1 trillion company. I mean, that just would have been unfathomable for you and I 20 years ago. So I think that what I find to be really interesting about the entrepreneurial mindset is that I think that any business today has the opportunity to succeed and thrive in the way that they want to. And I don't think that it has to be one specific path. And I think that if you follow too many of the industry headlines or sessions that you might see at an event, you might be led to believe otherwise. I think Peter Malouk on stage at the Deals and Dealmaker Summit sort of said, I think he said, in 5 to 10 years' time, there's probably going to be 20 firms, that 20 national RIAs that will get the bulk of the business, and sort of leading people to believe that the smaller firm is going to go by the wayside. And I fundamentally disagree. Like, I think if you're a founder, you are an entrepreneur at heart, you love to build, you love to have ownership, you have a vision, you're thinking about building a legacy business, I think that there's still unlimited opportunity and potential for you in this industry. And if you feel as though the right next step for your business, for whatever reason, is to sell to one of these larger platform businesses, there's incredible opportunities there too. I just don't think that it's one or the other. Like, I think that anything is possible based on the type of business that you want to build and the future that you see for yourself.
I agree. I was about to say the same thing. I think both points can be true. I mean, because you're already seeing it, you know, like to Peter's point, that a small number of firms are controlling a tremendous amount of assets. I think it was something like 7% of the firms control 75% of the assets. You know, so you definitely see that you're almost going to get barbell effect, right? You're going to get, you know, a lot of people heavily weighted at the top, but then you're still going to have a lot of successful smaller firms, you know, like you said, that can be still entrepreneurial and driven. I personally think the function of those firms might change a little bit. And I'd be curious as to your perspective on it, because, you know, back in the early days, I always looked at RIAs as they were real just asset managers. They were, you know, managing people's money. They started expanding into financial planning and other things as more things became available to them. But, you know, how do you think the small firm looks 5 years from now? Are they still going to be asset managers? What should their core competency be?
That's an interesting question. The way that I think about this is, as a business owner myself, is to think about who is my ideal client and how can I serve them better than anybody else. And I better build a business that can do that and that can stand behind that. And so I think the same holds true for advisory firms. And to your point, sort of the smaller firms, you know, what is expected of them? What does their business need to look like? What services do they have to offer? And this is a simple response, but simple is not always easy. But I mean, I think you have to build the business that your ideal client needs from you. And I think that that can and should potentially evolve over time. So if your ideal client is very, like, they're hiring you because of your investment management philosophy, and that's really how they found you, why they selected you, and where they derive the most value from, then I think it's okay to continue to have an investment management focused advisory firm. I think if that's not the case and your client really wants you to be that one-stop shop and just offload, like, I just don't want to think about it. Like, I just want to make sure, I just want to feel like everything is taken care of. And that could bleed into tax planning, which is one of the top services desired by consumers today. And there's some data to back that up from Herbers and Company that was conducted, consumer data that was conducted 2 years ago at this point. But Angie Herbers, who runs that company, runs statistical significance. She has a tool on the back end, and she still believes that she's within a low margin of change on the consumer answer. So that tax planning is one of the top services desired by consumers today. It used to be investment management, then financial planning, and then estate planning, and then tax planning. So like, if your client is looking to you for like tax planning, estate planning, I want to make sure that like my kids' colleges are taken care of, I need to make sure that like my charitable interests are fulfilled, then you have to build a business that offers that. And that's going to be required. But I think it should be driven by client need rather than industry pressure. I don't know about you, but we oftentimes see advisory firms sort of like do things because they think that they have to, and then that doesn't always work out.
Right.
So I think it should be driven by the reality of your ideal client and what they seek rather than what the industry says.
Yeah, I totally agree. What I question, though, is asset management getting commoditized further and further? So there's always been talk, for as long as I've been in the industry, people have been talking about, will there be fee compression on the 1% fee? And the 1% has held steady, But the way everybody identifies it is the compression is really an expansion of services. You're doing more for that 1% than you used to just get paid 1% to manage assets. And I think the pressure on getting 1% to manage assets is going to continue to drive down. People are going to expect more for that. So maybe you can build, you know, an asset management business, but I don't know that you're going to be able to command 1% for it.
Yeah, this is a good point. On the fee side, I think advisors today are feeling as though they're having to really define and communicate the value that's delivered for the fee that's charged. And to your point, it's no longer just, we invest, you know, we're your asset manager, we're going to invest your portfolios, and it's going to be 100 basis points on the assets. I do think that consumers have greater expectations around what they're paying for and what they're receiving in return.
Agreed. And so talk to me a little bit about where Vicom plays in terms of helping advisors grow. Because now I'm going to project myself into your world a little bit and tell me where I'm wrong. But I imagine one of the things that the scaled higher end enterprise firms have an advantage of is that scale and the ability to spend time and resources against client acquisition. You know, where if you're on the smaller side, maybe that's a little tougher. And how do you go about growing your firm from that smaller side when you don't have this, you know, the same kind of resources those large firms can dedicate? So, you know, how do you see that, and how does Vicom play, and what do your clients look like, and how do they use you?
Yeah, so we tend to work with advisory firms that are managing anywhere from about $1 billion to $20 billion in assets under management that are either founder-led or G2-led, and to maintain governance over their P&L and decision-making. So typically, our clients are sort of looking to build enterprise value so that when they get to the point that they're thinking about what's next for the founders, that they have really strong enterprise value and that they're in control of what that next decision is, whether it's to bring on a debt partner, a minority investor, or to look for a majority acquisition. And so we're helping our clients to build greater marketing enabled organic growth and to do so in a repeatable and scalable way. And so the easiest way to think about our work with those advisory firms is that we're essentially they're both their outsourced chief marketing officer and their outsourced marketing department. So we offer strategy that's tightly aligned to business goals and objectives. And then on an ongoing basis, we execute against the strategy. And so that would be for firms that are still have 100% control of their business and they're in growth mode, they're investing in growth. We do also work with larger national enterprises like you're referring to, but in a different way. So we work with those firms to help them accelerate individual advisor growth through our growth coaching program, sort of like modern day practice management. But we come in and help those enterprises drive greater growth at the individual advisor level by coaching them on their own marketing frameworks, how to show up in their own local markets while supporting the brand, the corporate brand. And there's some accountability and peer experience sharing, lots of resources and frameworks and tools that are a part of that coaching program. So we work on both sides. I would say that the headlines and what, you know, the leaders will talk about on stage is that these large national enterprises are growing faster than the smaller ones. And I know that there's data to back that up. In my experience, when you peel the layers of that onion back, it's not often marketing-driven growth that's leading to their impressive organic growth rates. So what we often find that's like a really big accelerant on growth for those larger firms is that when they acquire a new firm, that new firm has access to a lot of new services. And so the ability to take $100 or $200 million AUM firm and quickly accelerate it into a $300 million AUM firm just by providing more services, and maybe it's not just the increase in the assets, but it's also the increase in revenue, that's creating a lot of value and growth. The industry as a whole is still really struggling to understand and clearly identify where marketing is actually driving outsized growth. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But I know many of the CMOs at these large national RIAs, and it's not a simple solution. And I think part of that is because these national RIAs, even though to us in the RIA world, they're like massive mega firms, they still don't have anywhere near the brand name recognition as the Goldman Sachs Merrill's, Morgan's, UBS's. And so if you think about, we talked about Peter Malukin creative planning earlier. So if you think about them as an example, we all know who creative planning is, but if you were to go out and solicit, you know, just an informal survey of the people who live on your street,
sure,
no one would probably know who they are. So that's a challenge for these larger firms. They're working very hard to build brand recognition, to understand what type of return they're looking for. And then they're also trying to figure out, outside of purchasing leads, so working with a Smart Asset or a Zoe or a Wiser Advisor or a Dataline or similar, how do you bring leads in cold through your digital efforts? And what does that look like? What type of content do you need to be producing? How are you distributing it? When are you distributing it? On what channel? How are you increasing the percentage of unqualified to qualified leads every month? And so that's still very much a work in progress, which I actually think gives a competitive advantage to the smaller firms, because there is the ability to really dominate a local market and to have influence in a local market, and to do so in a way that's scalable and efficient from a budget perspective, because you're not trying to go out and build brand recognition all across the country. You're in, whether it's a geographic local market or it's a very specifically defined target market, you can focus small and you can have greater, I think, greater efficiency and better leverage on outcomes by virtue of the fact that you're small.
I'll take the opportunity to tell a little story from my marketing background. So I was the chief marketing officer of the first internet bank in the country. And we took a similar approach. And when we launched, we didn't go with a big national campaign. We went market by market, right? And so we launched our first campaign into Los Angeles. And we bought billboards and we bought radio ads and we had TV spots and we did newspaper advertising and just, you know, all over the place. And I thought the billboards kind of, you know, were, you know, outdoor advertising kind of were a facsimile to a bank branch, because we had no branches. And we were hugely successful in that, because you could get the, you know, you could get the, you know, the repetitive impressions that you need to build brand and drive awareness and get response. And then it was super interesting that, because it was such a new concept, people probably didn't think about it too much. But when we surveyed our customers a year later into it, something like 85% of them didn't realize we didn't have a branch in LA. So it was, you know, kind of amusing. But I completely agree with that approach of the local firm having some advantages in that way of getting their dollars to go further and their efforts to go further because of that concentration. But I think a big message from, you know, hearing all you were just talking about is, when firms need to think about organic growth, they can't think about a marketing effort, like let's run a couple ads and see if we can't get a couple leads. It's really a commitment to it, you know, because it's an ongoing program. It's not something that's going to, you run a couple ads and you're going to get a couple stream of clients. It's really an ongoing program. You've got to be dedicated to it. You've got to dedicate resources, both dollars and people, to really making it successful. And you know, maybe you can, you know, talk about that.
Yes, I would say yes. Preach, David. Yeah, I mean, I think where we are today in the industry is that advisory firms are recognizing that marketing needs to be an integrated discipline in the business and not just an afterthought. And to your point, that it has to be a commitment that is made for the future growth of the business, that marketing is going to be a driver of growth in ways that it hasn't in the past. And so I think that that's a big shift. Like I said, I've been working in this industry for over 20 years. And when I started on the insurance broker dealer side of the world, that actually had a very early hybrid RIA model. So I worked for an independent RIA that was also affiliated with an insurance broker dealer. And back then, nobody talked about marketing. And I was hired to build out the value-added marketing support for this large agency within an insurance broker dealer career agency system, because it was right after the Do Not Call legislation came out. And none of these advisors knew what to do if they couldn't cold call seniors to like sell them insurance or annuities.
Right.
And so it was like, I had no idea what I was doing. It was 20 years old, but they were like, help us do this. And so at that time, like, no one talked about marketing. And then when I started FICOM, which was in 2012, I still felt like if I was speaking at an event that I was standing up on the stage and sort of like shouting from a megaphone that you need to pay attention to marketing. And most people in the audience just didn't want to believe me. And so today that's different. And today we do, I feel sort of from FICOM's perspective that advisory firms are paying a lot more attention. They're recognizing that what got them here isn't going to get them there. They're recognizing that how they're achieving organic growth is different, that modern consumers' buying preferences have changed, that people are building trust online, and that they need to think about marketing in different ways in order to continue to achieve the level of growth that they have. And also, it's different to achieve 10% net new asset growth on $100,000 than it is on $1 billion. It's just the numbers get bigger. And so, you know, that is something that I'm excited about, which is obviously I bring my own like selfishness and bias to that because I run a firm that does this for advisory firms. But I do get excited about the investments that are being made into marketing as a growth driver. And you're right that it has to be ingrained as part of the business. It has to be talked about at the leadership level. There has to be a commitment from the executive team. There has to be an openness and willingness by everybody at the firm to get on board and to support it. And there also has to be a recognition that this is sort of a, on a go-forward basis, it's going to be part of your expenses and that you're not looking to minimize it. Because I often get that question, well, if we spend 5% of revenue this year, can we spend 2% of revenue next year? And my point is, well, then your marketing's not working.
Right.
Because if your marketing were working, you'd be coming to me and saying, I want to spend 7% because look at what I got last year.
Totally. And I think that's, you know, a big misperception that people have about marketing. A lot of them think of it in terms of like brand marketing, like you know, you're just getting your name out there and hoping people recognize. But there are so many tactical things that you can do that are very measurable, that you can understand the performance of, understand the return on your investment. And again, like you're saying, marketing done well, if you're getting the return that you design, that, okay, we know if we spend X amount to get a customer, that's a very profitable spend. It's like, well, for how long can we spend that amount of money and still get that return? And as long as we can do that, we should do it all day long. Right.
Right. Right. Yeah. And to go back to our earlier conversation about the leverage that you can get out of a dollar being, I think you can get more leverage as a smaller firm than a bigger firm. The bigger firms have more budget to put behind some of these lead generation efforts. And so they can afford to spend money to get a 2% conversion ratio. So if you have 100 leads that come in, you're going to convert 2. Smaller firms don't have that privilege because they don't have the same manpower to work 100 leads to only close 2. And most advisors who have built their business primarily based on referrals are not used to a 2% conversion ratio. So they get fatigued. It's a distraction from their what they do best. And so they give up. And so that's where I think the shift in mindset also has to happen with firms that are not these large national RIAs with big sophisticated marketing departments and, you know, 7-8 figure, 9 figure in some cases budgets, right? Like if you think about how much Ken Fisher spends at USPS, I think that Fisher Investments keeps USPS in business. But there are a lot of opportunities to be very efficient with your marketing spend. And so to your point, it's like if I can get an advisory firm in front of 10 qualified prospects and they can close 8, I don't care that it's only 10, right? I didn't have to get them in front of 100 to close 2. And so it's thinking about really like, how can you leverage the best of what the business is? How can you leverage the relationships, the influence that you have in your local community? And how can you essentially like augment that? And so there's really, really exciting things. And I don't mean to say that marketing doesn't work at these large national RIAs, because it does. Clearly, it works very, very well. It's just a totally different mindset. And so if you're a firm that is not a large national RIA platform and you're looking across the landscape and thinking, what should I do for marketing? I would say, don't look at those national firms, because that's, you're not going to be able to replicate it. You shouldn't want to, but look at the opportunities that you do have right in front of you. You know, don't step over a dollar to pick up a dime and focus on what you have.
Yeah. So we've really helped firms with organic growth in a different way. And one of the ways you mentioned, like a lot of the larger firms do when they acquire, you know, a firm that was smaller and maybe they didn't offer the breadth of services that would now be available. And we do it by offering products and services that firms might not have had available. So we can help with wallet share, we can help bring in held away assets, attract some new customers. And you really focus on organic growth from, you know, like truly, you know, finding those new customers. And they're both super valued things, you know, going back to to the Echelon conference, they were talking about valuations of firms. So if you're thinking about selling your firm, you're showing organic growth is hugely valuable.
I think there's some data on that, like the multiple effect of having demonstrated scalable organic growth, whether it's the work that you're doing at DPL or other ways that you can build scale around your organic growth, but that definitely increases enterprise value. And that's what we see. That's sort of the journey that many of our clients are on. And it's not always to look for a capital partner, but there's always some goal of wanting there to be enterprise value that's fully maximized. And in order to have it fully maximized, marketing as a repeatable growth engine has to be a piece of that.
Yeah. And they, within that organic growth, I forget what they were saying, but you know, there are certainly ways of identifying. And a lot of firms, you know, we've talked to over the years, the economy has been doing well generally. Markets have been going up and firms have therefore been growing. But these PE-backed firms are sophisticated enough to understand the difference between market growth and true organic growth. And so while it might feel good and you feel like you're growing, they're going to know the difference and you're going to get paid for one, real organic growth, and you're not going to get paid for market growth. So if you are thinking about potentially selling your firm, which I do think it's, if you're in that mindset, it's a great time to do it, as you were mentioning earlier, but take advantage of organic growth before you sell it. Like put in some program, use us to help you attract assets, show organic growth, you know, use a firm like yours in order to generate new clients, because then you get paid on it. Because if you don't, once you get acquired, the firm who acquired you is going to use us, going to use you, and they're going to help grow and they're going to get the economic benefit. So do it for yourself before you start putting yourself on the market.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that I like to see and hear the stories when a founder sells and they felt like they were in complete control, right? Like they knew why they were selling. They knew what their non-negotiables were. They knew how they wanted their clients and their team to be taken care of. And they were able to find that solution. Like those are the best stories. The stories that are not as fun to hear are the ones where people were backed into a corner for a number of reasons and didn't have a succession plan or had an unexpected situation arise or whatever it may be and felt like they had to compromise on some of their non-negotiables or not put as much thought into the sale as they would have liked to. And so to your point, like now's the time. There's never a time that's too early to start thinking about how you can improve enterprise value by thinking differently and creatively about your organic growth and the drivers of your organic growth so that when the time comes, you're in complete control of the process and you've got the options that you seek and there's multiple options today, which is awesome, but that you don't feel pressured.
Yeah. I mean, just like everything you've been talking about here, be very purposeful about it, you know, because as we've seen in the RIA industry over the last couple of decades, one, becoming an RIA is a lot easier today. There's so many resources to help you do that. If you're thinking about breaking away from a wirehouse, broker dealer, wherever, there's so many resources to help you do that. There's so many different ways you can set up your RIA today. And then on the other end of the spectrum, when you're thinking about potentially selling your practice, there are many different options for doing that.
Yes.
If you want to, you know, maintain more independence and control your own brand, you know, there are options for that. If you want to tuck into a bigger firm and just become part of a large enterprise, you know, you can do that too. But be aware of all the options because there are many. And from selling the entire business to selling parts of it to selling parts of the revenue, there are so many different ways that you can monetize your practice or start thinking about selling entirely.
Yeah. I mean, if we just think about the people that were on site, whether they were just attendees or speakers at the Echelon Deals and Dealmakers Summit, I mean, the number of buyers and investors were plentiful. There's unlimited options, which I find that to be really exciting.
Yes. So if you're interested, just put your name out there and you'll be getting calls.
Yeah.
If you're not getting calls already.
I was gonna say, they probably already are.
Totally. But again, I agree with you that the independent firm is always going to have a future.
Yeah.
But the large firms are going to continue to grow. It'll continue to gobble up other firms. And you're going to see, I think, an increased number of breakaways from the traditional channels, because I think brands, I think, don't matter as much anymore, really across the board, but in financial services. And even ironically, you see, you know, in some survey work, some of the biggest name financial services brands are some of the lowest thought of.
I know.
Right? So in some ways, you've got an opportunity to really differentiate by not being affiliated with some of those brands.
I think that's been a validating insight that the industry has experienced, which is we know this to be true, that this is such a relationship-based business. And so the human relationship trumps all things. And so I think what the breakaway movement has proven is that the trust that is placed in some of these large private banks and global banks is important for some, but not important for all. I think that used to be the narrative, you know, like come to Merrill Lynch and we're going to, you know, we've got the stability and the strength and the trillions of dollars of assets. And I just don't think that that matters to as many people as we used to believe. I think that what matters the most is that as a client, if I'm the end client, that I work with a financial advisor that I feel totally gets me. They see me, they understand me, they hear me, and they provide a service that is so inherently built for what I need that I have trust and respect. And that's why these advisor retention ratios are like 98%, because their clients trust them. And that's really what it's about. And so when I think about that through the lens of marketing, I think that there is an opportunity to really leverage that and to leverage the human aspect of any brand and to be very human first and heart centered in how you show up in the market, so that you can make sure that when you are in front of a prospective qualified client, that you're resonating with them based on what they're seeking. And I think it's often easier to do that when you've got a very narrow focus instead of a broad focus. I think that there's work required for most firms to get there, because today many advisory firms sound very similar. You know, if you were to land on their webpage, you would probably read something along the lines of, you know, we provide investment management, financial planning, holistic wealth management to families, institutions, and businesses. Which yep. says, I do all things for all people. And if you're saying I do right. all things for all people, it means you do nothing for no one. And so I think that there's some work to do to sort of shift the perspective of your messaging and how you're showing up in a way that like can clearly identify, this is the exact type of client that I serve better than anybody else. This is what I know they're worried about. This is what I know their pain points are. This is how I serve them better than anyone else. And so oftentimes there's a lot of tweaks that we can make just in messaging that can provide really dramatic impact to the results of a firm's marketing efforts, because you're all of a sudden, people can self-identify when they land on your website. And then by the time they finally meet with you, they've more or less chosen that they want to work with you, and they're just kicking the tires to make sure that what they see in real life matches what they've experienced online. But yes, I think that the brands today, brands are still important. So I don't want to mislead anybody. Like if you think about driving down the street, if you had a prospect that was driving down the street, your brand is essentially your house. And so you want your prospect to be attracted to your house instead of the other houses on the street. And that's your brand. But when you invite them in, you want them to stay. And that's sort of where the human relationship comes into play. And that's where I think localized marketing efforts that are authentic and vulnerable and real are outperforming those that are sort of generic and canned.
So as we, you know, kind of wrap up here, tell everyone about FICOM a bit. Like, what's your team look like? What kind of, you know, capabilities you bring? You've talked about, you know, a lot of different things, and it can be daunting for people who have not undertaken a real marketing program and marketing effort. And you just tell them what kind of support you can help provide, because organic growth is so important and so many people talk about it, but to do something about it, you've got to make that commitment. How can you help them? What does your staff look like?
Yeah. So at FICOM, we essentially provide greater marketing enabled organic growth. We do that through strategy. We have full marketing and PR execution capabilities, and then advisor coaching. So we come in at the leadership level and sort of work alongside as a member of the leadership team to create the marketing strategy that is specific to your business. And that's where our strategic, sort of senior strategic leads come in, and they provide that outsourced CMO level strategic work. And then we also have a team of people that are incredible sort of technicians across the marketing and PR sort of umbrella where we can execute against the strategy. So there's a ton of content creation that we do for our clients. We distribute it across channels based on the strategy, but we have full marketing and PR execution capabilities. And so that's what we do at the sort of executive and corporate level. And then we also help our clients to drive outsized growth by making sure that every individual at the firm, every individual advisor at the firm is leveraging their unique capability to show up and drive greater growth. And so we do that through coaching. So for firms that are feeling uncertain and unsure, like we just don't even know where to begin, or we've had a bad experience, or we've tried this and it didn't work, or we've tried some marketing, but it actually brought in too many unqualified leads. We're a really good partner for firms that are feeling like marketing isn't the driver of growth that they want it to be in the business, that they value that, and that they want to invest in it, and they're looking for a long-term partner. So we work with our clients on a retained capacity. Very proud of our client tenure, and we grow right alongside our clients as their businesses grow and evolve.
That's terrific. And I'm biased because it's my background. I believe in marketing. I love marketing. It's always my passion still, and well worth the investment. Whether you're thinking about selling your firm or not, generating organic growth and doing it in a very smart, measurable, marketing-driven way, I think not enough firms do it. And making the commitment to doing it and having a firm like FICOM, who's got deep expertise in the space, I think people should check you out and talk to you about growth, because I think if they've got the commitment, they'll be very pleasantly surprised with the results and be very happy with making the choice and the investment.
Well, thank you. And likewise, I think that was one of the reasons that you and I clicked so quickly when we first met. And also Heather, who's fantastic on your team, is that I believe that both of our businesses are providing really differentiated value to the clients that we serve. And I think it's important for advisory firms to really know and understand the type of partner that they're seeking to help them drive growth and know that they've got endless options available. And so I think it's a privilege to be where I am today in this business that I've built and the types of firms that we seek to serve. And I know that you feel the same way. And so if we can do anything, even just through sharing ideas, honestly, to help people, to help, advisory firms drive greater organic growth so that they can serve more people, then that's a good day for me.
Excellent. That's great. I appreciate the time, Meg. It's so good to have you on.
Thanks, David.
All right. Great to see you, Meg. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. To hear more advisor revelations, go to dplfp.com and subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming app.